for the market balance. If other energy carriers, and especially oil, gas, and petrochemical companies, join Iran's energy exchange on futures platform, Iran's crude oil and gas is capable enough to be turned into a benchmark for pricing in the region.
As Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, the pricing benchmark for our gas and oil should not be elsewhere. The fact is that we should have our own pricing reference for our natural gas in the region. We hope that with the launch of futures and cooperation of all companies in the field of oil and gas, such a thing will happen.
Futures are some very important instruments for the market balance, while there are also some strong hedging tools. They provide investment opportunities for those who are seeking the amount of profit more than they can earn in the normal market deals.
Futures contracts are financial contracts obligating the buyer to purchase an asset or the seller to sell an asset at a predetermined date and price in the future.
The launch of futures trade markets at Iran's energy exchange will contribute to transparency and the predictability of Iran's economy. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Islamic Jihad movement held a national conference for women in the Gaza Strip on the occasion of International Women's Day. The conference, titled Woman is the Icon of Resistance, highlighted the role of Palestinian women in fighting the Israeli occupation and their struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinian women in the Gaza Strip paid a heavy toll during Israel's war on coastal enclave last year. According to human rights groups, the Israeli regime killed 60 women and 22 children in 2021.
We are supporting our women. We called the international, we addressed the international human rights to support our women, asking the international committee to protect the women, to protect the children, to stop the occupation forces against the women in Palestine.
Addressing the conference through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Dr. Ziad Nakhala praised the role of Palestinian women in their struggle against the Israeli regime for more than seven decades.
Palestinian women will not allow anyone to stop her resistance, consider it to be a red line. Palestinian women share military and political struggle with men. Palestinian women has given a lot for her homeland and abroad.
Conference attendees discussed ways of developing new strategies for women to confront the Israeli regime and its illegal practices, especially against women.
Palestinian women today meeting in Gaza to discuss about the role for women, for Palestinian women, and to discuss issues about how to defend the Palestinian in Palestine.
The annual event also tackled ways of bringing international attention to the plight of Palestinian women.
Palestinian women say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a visit to the leaders of six European nations, plus a visit with the European Union and Israel's foreign minister, with a closed-door meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron. Washington has just announced a ban on Russian fossil fuels, but Blinken has apparently not convinced the European Union to immediately sever energy ties with their primary supplier. Russia announced they would cut its oil supplies to Europe if they introduced energy sanctions, which would have a devastating economic impact, perhaps globally. In what many say is an effort to avoid peace and increase the likelihood of a major war, Blinken recently announced that NATO members can send fighter jets to Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe have already provided significant military aid to Ukraine and imposed sanctions so potentially sweeping that Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin recently said they were, quote, like a war.
France is not directly concerned in this conflict, and yet they've already overdone it. When their foreign minister declared an all-out economic and financial war against Russia, that is an act of war. However, there's no economic coherence here because Europe completely depends on Russia for gas, petrol, and titanium, while the loss of export sales to Russia would be a catastrophe for European agriculture.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky recently announced that he, quote, understood that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine, end quote, which appears to be a concession to one of Russia's primary demands to end its military operation. The risk of expanding the conflict is a major concern, and with Washington giving Russia a cold shoulder since their offensive, Macron has served as the West's primary mediator with Moscow.
Macron has failed in his mediations because he and Germany have not been able to convince Ukraine to respect the Minsk agreements. If Macron had been able to convince Ukraine of this, then things could have been quite different. France should have been able to achieve this, but the United States obviously didn't want it.
Since 2014, some 14,000 people have been killed in Ukraine. Russia's offensive on February 24th has produced almost 500 civilian deaths and nearly 2 million refugees, according to the United Nations. In recent years, many politicians have argued that the European Union is necessary in order to have peace on the continent. However, forming an EU army, sending arms within Europe, and waging a sanctions war, which is sure to hurt the Russian people, doesn't seem peaceful to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Children also seem to be able to clear SARS-CoV-2 from their bodies much quicker than adults can, says Smriti Malapati, writer, in an article published under the heading, Kids Show Mysteriously Low Levels of COVID Antibodies. Here's the story. Children infected with SARS-CoV-2 are less likely than adults to produce antibodies against the virus, despite having similar symptoms and levels of virus in their bodies, according to a small study in Australia. Researchers say the findings add to the growing body of evidence suggesting that children have a more robust initial immune response to COVID-19 and can clear the infection quickly, compared with adults. But because antibodies are likely to be important for guarding against reinfection, the findings raise questions about how well protected children might be against future infections. The study published in JAMA Network Open on March 9th looked at 57 children with a median age of 4 and 51 adults with a median age of 37 who tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 between May 10th and October 28, 2020. Participants had mild symptoms such as headaches and fevers or were asymptomatic. The researchers took nose and throat swabs to measure participants' levels of viral RNA and blood samples to check for immunoglobulin G antibodies against the virus. They found that children and adults had similar viral loads, but only 37% of children produced SARS-CoV-2 antibodies compared with 76% of the adults. Previous studies have also seen differing antibody responses in kids compared with adults. An analysis by Donna Farber, an immunologist at Columbia University in New York City, and her colleagues found that adults produce a broader set of antibodies, including more virus-blocking antibodies than children do. Farber says the Australian analysis confirms and extends those findings. children could be producing fewer antibodies because they have a more robust innate immune response than adults. This is the first line of defense against pathogens and is non-specific. Children could also be better at responding to infections where they enter the body, such as through the throat or nose. This means the body clears the virus quickly and it doesn't hang around to trigger the adaptive response that produces antibodies, says Farber. Other studies, including by Kirsten Mayer, a cellular geneticist at the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Hingston, UK, have shown that children mount a stronger and faster response to an infection, and that the innate immune system has an important role in that response. The younger the child, the more likely it is that their innate immune system is driving that response, says Mayer. But Paul Lisiardi, an immunologist at Children's Research Institute in Melbourne and co-author of Australian study, says that when he and his team looked at innate immune cells in a small group of children, they didn't find a stronger response in those who didn't produce antibodies. This is something to look into, he says. The Australian team also measured some participants' levels of immune cells in the blood. They found lower levels of certain classes of antibody-producing memory B cells and memory T cells in children than in adults. This suggests that kids mount less of an adaptive immune response, which is more targeted and generates immune memory, says Betsy Herold, a pediatric infectious disease physician at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. The team worries that if kids have a less vigorous adaptive immune response, that could put them at risk of reinfection. But Harold calls for caution here. We don't have the data yet to make that conclusion. Children might not be as protected from reinfection, but there is still at very low risk of complications from the initial infection, says Mayer. The Australian study also looked only at people who were infected with early variants of SARS-CoV-2, but the results might differ for the more infectious Delta and Omicron variants. In preliminary analysis of people infected with Delta in 2021, Lisiardi says he and his team found that most children and adults produced antibodies in response to an infection, which could be because Delta is associated with higher viral loads. The Australian team is now collecting immunological data from people who have been infected with Omicron.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Today, training researchers and scientists is a long-term need. The issue of procreation and reproduction, which I have been emphasizing so much, is another example. Today, if we do not think about reproduction, then it will be late to solve the problem in 15, 20 years. We will become a country that does not have enough of the necessary elements to move forward. That is, the youth. Today, we have to think about tomorrow. that is the youth. Today we have to think about tomorrow. Another example is nuclear energy, on which the whole world is becoming increasingly dependent on a daily basis. We too need peaceful nuclear energy sooner or later. Today, if we do not think about it, if we do not follow the matter, it will be late tomorrow, and our hands will be empty. When the world dominates all aspects of this issue, it will be difficult for us to move forward that day. So, you see how cruelly the enemy front is focusing on the issue of our nuclear energy. They impose sanctions while they know that our nuclear energy project is peaceful. They say that Iran is such and such an amount of time away from proceeding a nuclear bomb. These are nonsensical and meaningless remarks.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They themselves know that we are not looking for nuclear weapons, and that we are only looking for the peaceful use of nuclear energy. They understand and know this. They do not want the Iranian nation to achieve this great and significant scientific progress, and they are putting pressure on us because the nation will need it tomorrow, and they do not want this movement to continue. If we fail to address these future and long-term issues today, we will face problems tomorrow. In the case of the JCPOA in 2015-2016, my objection was that certain points had to be observed so that no further problems would arise. My objection was mainly to this. I said to the officials that they had to consider certain points, and I frequently mentioned them in my recommendations. Well, some of those points did not receive attention, and therefore the subsequent problems that everyone is aware of arose. So looking to the future and being prepared for it is important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
22.8 million Afghans, more than half the population, are facing acute food insecurity, left by the administration's hold on billions of central bank reserves. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Mark Weisbrot, writer. In an article published under the heading, Biden's sanctions on Afghanistan could kill more civilians than two decades of war. Stay tuned for more. When President Joe Biden decided to withdraw the U.S. military from Afghanistan last year, much of America's news media came down on him like a ton of bricks. Republicans piled on, calling the withdrawal an unmitigated disaster. But getting out was the right move. In fact, the real mistake was the opposite. The Biden administration did not end the war, but continued it by other means, which are turning out to be more violent and destabilizing. The economic sanctions imposed by the United States and its allies are causing widespread, severe hunger in this desperately poor country. Unless the U.S. sanctions are soon reversed, it is estimated that more people will die from the economic impact of sanctions over the next year than the number of who died in 20 years of war. The most destructive economic sanction is the U.S. confiscation of more than $7 billion in international reserves belonging to Afghanistan's central bank. The reserves are needed for essential imports such as food and medicine, but also for the central bank to play its normal role in maintaining and functioning financial system and economic stability. Aid groups trying to distribute food and save people's lives cannot, in many cases, move the necessary funds, and the healthcare system has been collapsing. World Bank data released last month shows that food prices increased at an estimated 40% annual rate since August, putting food out of reach of many poor Afghans. As a result of this economic disruption, including the loss of billions of dollars of aid, 22.8 million people, more than half the population, are facing acute food insecurity. They include a million children under five at risk of dying due to severe acute malnutrition, according to UNICEF. It is not clear why the Biden administration has imposed such devastating sanctions on Afghanistan. The sanctions do not seem to be directed at overthrowing the Taliban. Rather, it could be that the Biden administration, after its bad political experience with the military withdrawal, does not want to take the risk of appearing to be soft on the Taliban. This is a political miscalculation as well as a moral one. The lethal effects of U.S. sanctions in other countries have been mostly ignored because the sanctions have been widely misunderstood as punishing governments rather than whole populations. But the case of Afghanistan is beginning to correct this misunderstanding. The most influential humanitarian organizations are explaining the grim chain of casualty in public. David Miliband, former British Foreign Secretary and head of the International Rescue Committee, which has 3,000 staff in Afghanistan, told the U.S. Senate last month, "The proximate cause of this starvation crisis is the international economic policy, which has been adopted since August, and which has cut off financial flows not just to the public sector, but in the private sector in Afghanistan as well." At the same hearing, Graham Smith of the International Crisis Group told senators, "You need to address the reason why people are hungry, which is the collapse of the economy mostly due to Western economic restrictions." On February 11th, the Biden administration issued an executive order to allocate Afghanistan's central bank funds. Half of it, about $3.5 billion, would be for the benefit of the Afghan people, and the other half would be for millions of the victims of September 11 terrorist attacks, pending the outcome of legal claims. In other words, none of the $7 billion Washington is holding would be returned to the central bank. Therefore, it continues the destruction of the Afghan economy and the resulting mass starvation. No amount of foreign aid will make up for that, and so far it's not clear how the Afghan people will benefit from the $3.5 billion reserved for them. As for the pending lawsuits, this appears to be a political distraction. The legal issues are not all clear and could take years to resolve. How many poor people in Afghanistan should die to protect the U.S. government from the possibility that it could end up with a tiny addition to its budgets for this compensation? Some relatives of 9/11 victims who have spoken publicly about these questions have said emphatically that they don't want to take any money away from people in Afghanistan. Human Rights Watch immediately criticized the executive order, noting that the restrictions on the banking system are intensifying the country's already serious human rights crisis. Other groups and experts concerned with humanitarian issues joined in. If Afghanistan continues to descend into a nightmare of starvation, suffering, and death, the Biden administration will not escape blame for this as well as for the refugee crisis. More than a million Afghans are estimated to have fled since August. The Biden administration also will be blamed if the result is a failed state that allows for the establishment of a center for activity and recruitment, as happened in Syria when Daesh emerged there. Nearly 50 members of Congress warned Biden in a letter that economic collapse in Afghanistan due to U.S. sanctions could create ungoverned spaces and enable resentment against the United States, producing fertile ground for groups like Daesh to gain strength. Of course, the most important reason to end this nightmare is that these sanctions are threatening the lives of hundreds of thousands and possibly millions of innocent people. But if there are people in the Biden administration looking at this in strictly political terms, the political risks of destroying the Afghan economy are much greater than any potential fallout from Republican complaints about returning these reserves, which after all belong to the central bank and the Afghans. The sooner this is done, along with unfreezing money from International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the sooner the economy can recover, as David Beasley, the head of the World Food Program, has noted. And more civilians, especially children, who are disproportionately killed by severe food shortages, will live.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Afwai. Russia says the Pentagon is developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories on Ukrainian territory, and that Washington financially has supported a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens such as plague and anthrax. Sounds like a horrible conspiracy theory, but that is not how Russia sees it, leveling those accusations against the U.S. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. has felt the need for these biolabs in general, and then remind everyone about how the U.S. has used banned chemical weapons against civilian population in the past. Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, joins us from Budapest. And writer, radio host, and journalist Don DeBart joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to The Spotlight. Don DeBart, I'm going to first start with you and ask you this question. Moscow accusing Washington of financially supporting a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens like the plague and anthrax. But before your response, let's take a listen to what Vasily Nebenzia, Russia's representative at the UN, has said about this.
We convened the meeting today because as Russia is conducting a special military operation in Ukraine, we discovered a truly shocking fact of emergency cleanup by the Kyiv regime of the traces of a military biological program, which is being implemented by Kyiv with its support by the United States Ministry of Defense. Our Ministry of Defense, Russian Ministry of Defense, now has documents which confirm that on the territory of Ukraine, there was a network consisting of at least 30 biological laboratories in which very dangerous biological experiments were being conducted, aimed at strengthening the pathogenic qualities of the plague, anthrax, tularemia, cholera, and other lethal diseases using synthetic biology. This work is being done and funded and supervised by the Defense Threat Reduction Agency of the United States and in the interest of the National Center for Medical Intelligence, a unit of the United States Ministry of Defense.
Okay, so there you had it, Don DeBart. What do you think? The U.S. obviously is dismissing this as, I'm not going to use a bad word, but as nonsense. Russia says obviously what you just heard.
First, just for a little context, Russia called that meeting of the Security Council for Friday because it's one of the requisite steps in the process of triggering an investigation by the authorities that are provided for under the treaty outlawing those weapons. That's one piece of context. Another, as he mentioned, as Ambassador Nebenzia mentioned, the Defense Department agencies were involved in this research that Jen Psaki, one or two other officials, PR officials of the administration, said were civilian, healthcare-oriented facilities. It was not the CDC. It was not the WHO. It was the U.S. military that was in charge of those sites. And so that's significant. Now, he detailed, for example, 30 sites. We have documents, all of this, which are going to be provided to this investigation. The U.S. ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield, her first reply to this, that lasted 8 minutes or something, she did not make a factual, contest whatsoever, other than a general denial that it was lies, more lies, all of that kind of nonsense, and bad propaganda, fake news, etc. And then when Ambassador Nebenzia focused a little more on both her reply and what some of the U.S. allies on the council had mentioned, providing more detail, she said, "I'm not going to dignify this with a response." Now, she left that room, and the press was outside, and she held a press conference. This is exactly what she said, her total comment, after being accused in front of the world of violating the Biological Weapons Treaty and maintaining 30 bioweapons facilities in Ukraine and causing danger to both Europe and the Ukrainian people they're supposedly there to protect. "I know that you expect me to respond," she said, "but we're not going to give any more airtime to the lies that you're hearing today. It's beneath this council, and there's only one aggressor here, and that's Russia." That was her statement. Mm-hmm. So this followed by one day, to conclude, testimony under oath in front of a congressional committee by Victoria Nuland, or Victoria Nuland Kagan, as you may prefer, Robert Kagan's ex-spouse or spouse, under oath by a question, direct question by Senator Marco Rubio, "Does the U.S. have biological weapons in Ukraine?" She did not say the magic word, no. She did not say, absolutely not. She said the U.S. has biological facilities there, and she attempted to describe what goes on in there, and they fit the fact pattern of bioweapons, even as she tried to clean it up by characterizing it as something else.
She said, quote, and I'm going to ask you, George Samioli, about this, "Ukraine has biological research facilities, which in fact we are now quite concerned that Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we're working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into their hands." Given Victoria Nuland's statement there and what Don DeBar so greatly summed up for us, what are your thoughts about this discovery that Russia has announced at this time and the position that the U.S. has on this, in particular the Pentagon?
Well, I think Don DeBar has summarized it very well. It was very interesting what Victoria Nuland said, because remember, she was asked by Senator Marco Rubio, I think it was something like, "Does Ukraine have a biological weapons program?" I can remember that was the exact word. And then she started talking about these labs. It was a very strange response because, she could have indeed said, "No, of course not." Why then does she immediately start talking about these labs? Because obviously there has to be some sort of a link in her mind between that and a biological weapons program. And then, she said, "Well, we're very concerned about it falling into Russia's hands." Now, if indeed this is all perfectly innocent and here they were doing some research, purely in the interest of science to counter these terrible infectious diseases, why would be she would be so concerned with its falling into Russia's hands? What is she worried about? The theft of intellectual property? I mean, it was very, very odd. And then, of course, we had the series of denials and convoluted explanations that started pouring out of the U.S. government later that day, and they started then talking about, well, it's about the Soviet-era bioweapons program, and that we're all basically trying to destroy these Soviet-era bioweapons. But the problem there is, well, the Soviet Union came to an end more than 30 years ago. How long does it take to destroy bioweapons? I mean, if all you required, I would have thought, is to go into some desert somewhere and bury it deep underground. Why is that, that shouldn't have taken 30 years? And apparently, this U.S. activity in Ukraine has greatly expanded because it seems that there are now 30 of these labs in Ukraine. And then, of course, there are also of these labs in Georgia. So, again, very, very odd. And then particularly if it is all about these Soviet era bioweapons, then why again are they so worried about this falling into the hands of Russia? Because presumably Russia would know all about Soviet era bioweapons. Right. And then, of course, they came up with a lot of innocent explanation. It's all about, you know, these infectious diseases. The problem is this. There is, you know, even if you take everything at its most innocent, you have to then think, how would the United States feel if they found out that Russia had 30 biological research laboratories in Mexico? And particularly as we've just gone through a two years plus of a global pandemic, in which one very, very plausible theory as to the origin of the virus was a leak from a laboratory. So there are an awful lot of questions, and the United States is not coming up with any very plausible answers.
Well, let's take a step back here, and thank you for that. Obviously, great questions there. But Don DeBar, are we to conclude here, first of all, to come up with a couple conclusions here, that the U.S. in one way or another, whether it's their Defense Department or Pentagon or whatever other entity, were involved with these laboratories? Do you think then that that's the case? A. B, why would the U.S. be interested in having any type of involvement, whether it's just financing or having more input on this? What uses does this have for the U.S.? Because we're hearing about the plague or anthrax and, you know, these toxins that obviously kill lots of people.
Well, George summarized that, the whole case, really very well, too. And first, it raises, I want to go back just to something I mentioned earlier, because it's a very significant aspect. It's one thing for Jen Psaki or Kirby or one of these characters at a press conference to spew whatever comes out of their mouth. It's another thing, quite another thing, to testify in front of Congress under oath on a direct examination, answering a direct question, an unambiguous question, like the one that Senator Rubio asked of Newland. And what it attaches to isn't just the fear of perjury, and they do fear it. They respect that part of the process because it's a political weapon in their own internal political adversaries' hands if they hand it over. But it doesn't just happen in the context of politics here. You have these weapons, if that's what they are or whatever, these materials that they've admitted that are very nasty and very deadly, if people die as a consequence of that, first of all, their existence is most likely a violation of the treaty, and their existence in a war scenario, which Ukraine has been since 2013, 2014, war crime. Anyone that dies, crimes against humanity. Committing perjury in furtherance of that, you're in front of The Hague or, you know, depending on the outcome of this war, perhaps some sort of war crimes tribunal being administered by Russia and China. They are very cautious about these things, and you see that the answer is the person under direct questioning under oath answers the way she answered, and the PR people answer the way they answered. And that is very significant.
Okay. Well, George Samueli, some might say, you know, come on, how could this be, you know, having the plague or toxins like anthrax or viruses and the U.S. biolabs. But then when we take a look at a brief history check, which is a simple Google search, you come up with some. One of the ones that stands out in some respects are how U.S. forces were accused of using chemical weapons during their assault on Fallujah. That's back in 2003 in Iraq, in which there was evidence showing that the U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus during that time in that city, killing insurgents, as they call them, and civilians at the same time, which obviously causes burns and so forth and so on. So it's U.S. has been involved in using these types of weapons. So then is the conclusion that the U.S. is guilty of being a participant in these laboratories?
Well, that's very interesting because if you recall, after the 9/11 attacks, there was the big sequence, a very mysterious sequence of anthrax attacks, in which suddenly a whole bunch of people, very prominent people in government, received anthrax through the mail. And then eventually this was traced to a U.S. Government laboratory. Now, again, we came up with, they had an innocent explanation. Yeah, well, you know, there's experiments going on to counteract a particular anthrax attack. So that's all we're really doing. We're just sort of making sure that we have the the antibodies, you know, we have the vaccines against anthrax. That's why we have these laboratories. So that, I think, probably is something of the lines, if you can read, you know, try to figure out what the U.S. is doing. They're essentially figuring that they can stay within the terms of the Biological Weapons Convention by saying, well, what we're really doing is counteracting a possible chemical or biological weapons attack. So that doesn't really violate the Biological Weapons Convention. So in fact, we can go on doing all these dangerous experiments. I mean, it's basically like gain of function, you know, multiplied by 100. In other words, they're making these pathogens more and more lethal. And the justification for it is that, well, hey, supposing, you know, the Russians use these pathogens, we will have the means available to counteract that attack. But the point is that, of course, when you do this, when you create these very dangerous pathogens, then of course you can use them as a weapon yourself. It's not a problem. I mean, you've got the means to deliver these weapons, so you've got them at hand. So the Americans, I think, are, you know, legalistically saying, well, we're staying within the terms of the convention, because there is a vague formulation that, well, as long as it's kind of defensive, you're not kind of in violation of the convention. But essentially, you are creating dangerous pathogens that can indeed be used as weapons.
Well, does this argument stand, Don DeBar, for the U.S., I'm talking, that, you know, the there are facts that indicate that aside from these 30 biological labs, the U.S. supposedly is involved in 336 biological laboratories, which it controls in 30 countries around the world. It's very hard to do a fact check on this because it's just tough. But, you know, even if it's just a handful of those, well, 336, I mean, my God, that's a lot. Why does the U.S. feel then in such a scale to have laboratories that contain these types of viruses or banned chemical weapons? I mean, George Samueli said that, you know, just to counter the other side, but in over, 30 countries around the world?
You know, I guess if you're going to say that this is purely defensive, then you could say, well, a good spread around the globe in terms of distribution, in the event you have to deploy some sort of defensive agent, I guess that's what kind of nonsense we're going to hear. Probably that'd be Kirby, John Kirby at the Pentagon, his job to try to sell that. You know, obviously, what we have precedents after, most likely before, but certainly after September 11, 2001, the U.S. outsourced all kinds of things that are illegal to do here, torture, waterboarding, you know, all kinds of stuff. To dozens of countries around the world. I don't know exactly why they chose to do, say, six countries here instead of one or two, whether it has to do with the capacity of each of them to hide it, whether you need a geographic and a cultural mix for whatever, you know, work they're doing on these people. But, you know, there's three other words to consider here, by the way, while we're wondering about the U.S.'s record here, and that's Gulf War Syndrome. Okay, 250,000 American troops out of 697 veterans that were in the Gulf War, they were there for a couple of months, okay? Uncounted numbers of the millions of people in Iraq who were there when whatever happened, and the aftermath, and are still there. unexplained plague, basically, that killed lots of the 250,000 Americans. Those are the ones we have, you know, a lens on. And we have no idea how many Iraqis, for example, we know in the 90s, attributed to starvation and sanctions, were 400,000 dead Iraqi women and children that Madeleine Albright said was, you know, okay with her. We have no idea how many people died in Iraq of Gulf War syndrome, but Gulf War syndrome exists. And although they blame it on depleted uranium in some quarters, there's been no direct link to that. And it's quite possibly some pathogens involved in this. Sure. So, you know, the U.S., they have a habit of, you know, getting caught with their pants down and saying, well, you know, I'm going to take a shower. There's nothing nefarious here. Right. Even though there's a kindergarten next door where they're, you know, where they're headed.
Okay.
This stuff, you know, look at what just happened with COVID and how rapidly that spread around the world.
Indeed.
One of these things that some of these geniuses let loose on humanity, you know, you could be looking at a Charlton Heston moment like Omega Man or something faster than you can say Omega Man.
Well, indeed. And that's the depth of the problem here. And alarm bells should be ringing. Because we're looking at what has been reported by Russia, George Samueli. We're looking at this very alarming revelation, in a sense. And, of course, the U.S. saying that, you know, they're afraid that Russia is going to use them. Russia could obviously accuse the U.S. and, in turn, maybe then the Ukrainians' army, perhaps, of doing the same. But what are the chances, based on how things have transpired with the reports coming out, of these chemical entities being used in this war, one form or another? How do you see the danger of that happening?
Well, I think it's very dangerous because if you remember, in Syria, Barack Obama declared, well, here's our red line. If the government of Bashar al-Assad uses chemical weapons, then the U.S. will intervene militarily. And of course, lo and behold, the moment Obama said that, we suddenly have, you know, one chemical attack after another, which means that essentially when the U.S. government says this, this becomes a signal for people to use chemical or biological weapons as a false flag operation in order to trigger an American intervention. And we know that that has been the strategy of President Zelensky. I mean, he has no hope of winning this war, and he is clearly not winning the war. But the one thing he's got up his sleeve is this hope that the United States and NATO are going to come in on his behalf. Well, so far, you know, the Biden administration said, no, we're not going to do it.
Right.
However, there's a real question. Suppose there is suddenly a discovery of a biological weapons attack.
Okay.
You know, you have to then wonder whether the Biden administration will stick to its position, no intervention, and might use, because of the hysteria generated by an attack, to get involved militarily. So I think it is very dangerous.
Indeed. Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Do apologize for that. Don DeBar, the writer, radio host, and journalist from New York, spoke to us, gave his insights. Thank you, Don DeBar, and research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli there from Budapest. And with that, we can